Part 6. Guns Under the Table. The day John Boone was assassinated, we were up on East Elysium, and it was morning, and this meteor shower came raining down on us. There must have been 30 streaks or so, and they were all black. I don't know what those meteorites were made of, but they burned black instead of white, like smoke from crashing planes, except straight and fast as lightning. It was so strange to see that we all were amazed, and we hadn't even yet heard the news. But when we did, we figured back, and it happened at exactly the same time. We were down in Hellas Lakefront, and the sky went dark, and a sudden wind whipped over the lake and blew every walk tube in that town away, and then we heard. We were in Senzeni Na, where he worked a lot, and it was night, and lightning started hammering us. Giant bolts of lightning were shooting right down into the mohole. No one could believe it, and it was so loud you couldn't hear. And there was a picture of him down in the workers' quarters, up on the wall of one suite. And a lightning bolt hit the concourse window, and everyone was blinded for a second, and when our sight returned, the frame of that picture was busted, and the glass cracked, and it was smoking. And then we heard the news. We were in Carr, and we couldn't believe it. All the first 100 there were crying. He must have been the only one in that whole gang that everyone liked. If most of them were killed, a good half of the rest would be cheering. Arkady was out of his mind. He cried for hours, and it was so scary because it was so unlike him. Nadia kept trying to comfort him, and she was saying, "It's all right, it's all right," and Arkady kept saying, "It's not all right, it's not all right," and roaring and throwing things, and then falling into Nadia's arms again. Even Nadia was freaked. And that was when he ran off to his room and came back with one of the ignition transmitter boxes. And when he explained what it was, Nadia got really furious at all of us. She said, "Why would you ever do a thing like that?" And Arkady was crying and yelling, "What do you mean, why? Because of this. Because of what just happened to John. They killed him. They killed him. Who knows which of us will be next? They'll kill all of us if they can." And Nadia kept trying to give the transmitter back, and he got so upset he kept making her hold it, saying, "Please, Nadia, please, just in case, please," until finally she had to keep it to get him to calm down. I never saw anything like it. We were in Underhill, and the power went off, and when it came back on, every plant in the farm had frozen solid. The lights and heat came back on, and the plants all began to wilt. We sat around all night telling stories about him. I remembered what it was like when he first touched down back in the 20s. A lot of us did. I was just a kid at the time, but I remember everyone laughing at his first words. I thought it was funny myself, but I remember being very surprised that all the adults were laughing too. Everyone was so tickled. I think everyone fell in love with him at that moment. I mean, how could you not like someone who was the first person on another planet walking out there and saying, "Well, here we are"? It was impossible not to like him. Oh, I don't know. I saw him punch a man once. It was on the Burroughs train, and he was in our car, obviously high, and there was this woman who had some kind of deformity, a big nose and no chin. And when she went down to the toilet, some guy said, "My Lord, that woman has really been hit hard with the ugly stick." And Boone, bam, knocks him into the next seat and says, "There is no such thing as an ugly woman." That's what he thought. That is what he thought. Why, he slept with a different woman every night, and he didn't care what they looked like or how old they were. He had to talk fast when they found him with that 15-year-old. I don't suppose Toitovna ever heard of that one, or it would have been his balls, and hundreds of women would have gone wanting. He used to like to do it in 2-person gliders with the woman on top of him while he piloted. Oh, man, once I saw him pull a glider out of a downdraft that would have killed anyone else. It was a sheer-off, and it would have ripped the glider apart if he'd tried to resist it. But he just went with it, and the plane dropped like a rickover 1,000 meters in a second, 3 or 4 times terminal velocity. And then, when it was about to go smash, he just tweaked it to the side and up and pancaked it in about 20 meters. Came out with his nose and ears bleeding. He was the best pilot on Mars. He could fly like an angel. Hell, the whole first 100 would have been dead if he hadn't hand-flown them into their orbital insertion, that's what I heard. There were people who hated him, and with good reason, too. He stopped the mosque on Phobos from being built, and he could be cruel. I've never met a man more arrogant. We were on Olympus Mons, and the whole sky went black. Well, back before the beginning, Paul Bunyan came to Mars, and he brought his blue ox babe with him. He walked around looking for lumber, and his every footprint cracked the lava and left a rift canyon. He was so tall that he could reach into the asteroid belt while he walked around, and he chewed those rocks like Bing cherries and spit the pits out, and boom, there would be another crater. And then he ran into Big Man. It was the first time Paul had ever seen anyone bigger than himself, and believe me, Big Man was bigger. The usual 2 magnitudes, and that ain't just twice as big, let me tell you. But Paul Bunyan didn't care. When Big Man said, "Let's see what you can do with that axe of yours," Paul said, "Sure," and with one stroke he hit the planet so hard that all the cracks of Noctis appeared at once. But then Big Man scratched the same spot with his toothpick, and the entire Marineris system yawned open. "Let's try bare fists," Paul said, and he landed a right cross on the southern hemisphere, and there was Argyre. But Big Man tapped a spot nearby with his pinky, and there was Hellas. "Try spitting," Big Man suggested, and Paul spat, and Nergal Vallis ran as long as the Mississippi. But Big Man spat, and all the big outflow channels ran at once. "Try shitting," Big Man said. And Paul squatted and pushed out Saronius Tholus. But Big Man threw back his butt, and there was the Elysium Massif, right next to it, steaming hot. "Do your worst," Big Man suggested. "Take a shot at me." And so Paul Bunyan picked him up by the toe and swung his whole bulk around and slammed him into the North Pole so hard that that whole northern hemisphere is depressed to this day. But without even getting up, Big Man grabbed Paul by the ankle and caught up his blue ox babe in that same fist and swung them into the ground and slammed them right through the planet and almost out the other side. And that's the Tharsis Bulge. Paul Bunyan almost sticking out. Escrius, his nose, Pavonis, his cock, and Arcia, his big toes. And Babe is off to one side, pushing up Olympus Mons. The blow killed Babe and Paul Bunyan both, and after that, Paul had to admit that he was beat. But his own bacteria ate him, naturally, and they crawled all around, down on the bedrock and under the mega-regolith, down there going everywhere, sucking up the mantle heat and eating the sulfides and melting down the permafrost. And everywhere they went down there, every one of those little bacteria said, "I am Paul Bunyan." "It's a matter of will," Frank Chalmers said to his face in the mirror. The phrase was the only residue of the dream he had been having when he awoke. He shaved with quick, decisive strokes, feeling tense, crammed with energy, ready to be unleashed, wanting to get to work. More residue. Whoever wants it the most wins. He showered and dressed, padded down to the dining hall. It was just after dawn. Sunlight flooded Isidis with horizontal beams of red-bronze light, and high in the eastern sky, cirrus clouds looked like copper shavings. Rashid Niazi, the Syrian representative to the conference, passed by and gave Chalmers a cool nod. Frank returned it and walked on. Because of Selim el Heil, the Ahad wing of the Muslim Brotherhood had gotten blamed for Boone's assassination, and Chalmers had always been quick and public in defending them from all such accusations. Selim had been a lone assassin, he always asserted, a mad murder-suicide. This underlined the Ahad's guilt while at the same time commanding their gratitude. Naturally, Niazi, an Ahad leader, was a bit frustrated. Maya came into the dining room and Frank greeted her cordially, automatically covering the discomfort he always felt in her presence. May I join you? She said, watching him. Of course. Maya was perceptive in her way. Frank concentrated on the moment. They chatted. The subject of the treaty began to come up, and so Frank said, How I wish John were here now. We could use him. And then, I miss him. This kind of thing would distract Maya instantly. She put her hand over his. Frank scarcely felt it. She was smiling, her resting gaze full on him. Despite himself, he had to look away. The TV wall was showing the news package beamed up from Earth, and he tapped on the table console and turned up the sound. Earth was in bad shape. The video was of a massive protest march in Manhattan, the whole island packed with a crowd the protesters would call 10 million and the police 500,000. The helicopter images were quite arresting, but there were a lot of places these days that, although less visual, were much more dangerous. In the advanced nations, people were marching because of draconian birth reduction acts, laws that made the Chinese look like anarchists, and the young had erupted in fury and dismay, feeling their lives pulled out of their hands by a great crowd of ancient, unnatural, undead, by history itself come alive. That was bad, sure. But in the developing countries, they were rioting over inadequate access to the treatments themselves, and that was far worse. Governments were falling. People were dying by the thousands. Really, these images of Manhattan were probably meant to reassure. Everything's still orderly, they said. People conducting themselves in a civil manner, even if it be civil disobedience. But Mexico City and Sao Paulo and New Delhi and Manila were in flames. Maya looked at the screen and read aloud one of the Manhattan banners, Send the old to Mars. That's the essence of a bill someone's introduced in Congress. Reach 100 and you're off to retirement orbitals, the moon, or here. Especially here. Maybe, he said. I suppose that explains their stubbornness about emigration quotas. Frank nodded. We'll never get those. They're under too much pressure down there, and we're seen as one of the few escape valves. Did you see that program aired on Eurovid about all the open land on Mars? Maya shook her head. It was like a real estate ad. No, if the UN delegates gave us any say in emigration, they'd be crucified.
So what do we do?
He shrugged. Insist on the old treaty at every point. Act like every change is the end of the world.
So that's why you were so crazy about the preface material.
Sure. That stuff may not be all that important, but we're like the British at Waterloo. If we give at any point, the whole line collapses.
She laughed. She was pleased with him. She admired his strategy. And it was a good strategy, although it wasn't the one he was pursuing.
For they were not like the British at Waterloo. They were, if anything, like the French, making a last-ditch assault which they had to win if they wanted to survive. And so he had been very busy giving in on many points in the treaty, hoping to thrust forward and hold on to what he really wanted in other areas, which certainly included some remaining role for the American Martian Department and its secretary. After all, he needed a base from which to work. So he shrugged, dismissing her pleasure. On the TV wall, the crowds boiled up and down the great avenues. He clenched his teeth a few times.
We'd better get to it again.
Upstairs, the conferees were milling about in a sequence of long, high rooms that were divided by tall partitions. Sunlight streamed into the big central room from the eastern meeting chambers, throwing a ruddy glare over the white pile carpet and the squarish teak chairs and the dark pink stone of the long tabletop. Knots of people were chatting casually against the walls. Maya went off to confer with Samantha and Spencer. The three of them were now the leaders of the Mars First Coalition, and as such had been invited to the conference as non-voting representatives of the Martian population. The People's Party, the Tribunes, and the only ones there actually elected to their positions, although they were there only at Helmut's sufferance. Helmut had been as inclusive as anyone could ask.
He had allowed Anne to attend as a non-voting member representing the Reds, even though they were part of the coalition. Sachs was there observing for the terraforming team, and any number of mining and development executives were observing as well. There was a whole crowd of observers, in fact, but the voting members were the only ones to sit at the central table, where Helmut was now ringing a small bell. 53 national representatives and 18 UN officials took their seats, and another 100 continued to wander in the eastern rooms, watching the discussion through the open portals or on small TVs. Outside the windows, Burrows crawled with figures and vehicles, moving around in the clear-walled mesas, and the tents on and between the mesas, and in the network of connecting clear walk tubes that lay in the ground or arched through the air, and in the huge valley tent with its wide street grass boulevards and its canals, a little metropolis. Helmut called the session to order. In the eastern rooms, people clustered around the TVs. Frank glanced through a portal into the east room nearest him. There would be rooms like that all over Mars and Earth, thousands of them, with millions of observers. Two worlds watching. The day's topic, as it had been for the past 2 weeks, was emigration quotas. China and India had a joint proposal to make, which the head of the Indian office rose and read in his musical Bombay English. Stripped of camouflage, it came down to a proportional system, of course. Chalmers shook his head. India and China between them had 40% of the world's population, but they were only 2 votes of 53 at this conference, and their proposal would never pass. The Brit in the European delegation rose to point out this fact, not in so many words, of course. Wrangling began. It would go on all morning. Mars was a real prize, and the rich and poor nations of Earth were struggling over it as they were over everything else. The rich had the money, but the poor had the people, and the weapons were pretty evenly distributed, especially the new viral vectors that could kill everyone on a continent. Yes, the stakes were high, and the situation existed in the most fragile of balances, the poor surging up out of the south and pressing the northern barriers of law and money and pure military force. Gun barrels in their faces, in essence, but now there were so many faces, a human wave attack might explode at any instant, it seemed, just from the expansive pressure of sheer numbers. Attackers shoved over the barricades by the press of babies in the rear, raging for their chance at immortality. At the mid-morning break, with nothing more accomplished, Frank rose from his seat. He had heard little of the wrangle, but he had been thinking, and his lectern sketchpad was marked up with a rough schematic. Money, people, land, guns. Old equations, old trade-offs, but it wasn't originality he was after. It was something that would work. Nothing would happen at the long table itself, that was certain. Someone had to cut the knot. He got up and wandered over to the Indian and Chinese delegation, a group of about 10 conferring in a camera-free side room. After the usual exchange of pleasantries, he invited the two leaders, Hanavada and Sung, to take a walk on the observation bridge. After a glance at each other, and quick conversations in Mandarin and Hindi with their aides, they agreed. So the three delegates walked out of the rooms and down the corridors to the bridge, a rigid walk tube which began at the wall of their mesa and arched out over the valley and into the side of an even taller mesa to the south. The bridge's height gave it an airy flying magnificence. And there were quite a few people walking its 4 kilometers, or just standing midway and taking in the view of Burrows. Look, Chalmers said to his two colleagues, the expense of emigration is so great that you will never ease your population problems by moving them here. You know that, and you already have lots more reclaimable land in your own countries. So what you want from Mars isn't land, but resources, or money. Mars is leveraged to get your share of resources back home. You're lagging behind the North because of resources that were taken from you without payment during the colonial years, and you should have repayment for that now. I'm afraid that in a very real sense the colonial period never ended, Hanawada said politely. Chalmers nodded. That's what transnational capitalism means. We're all colonies now. And there's tremendous pressure on us here to alter the treaties so that most of the profits from local mining become the property of the transnationals. The developed nations are feeling that very strongly. This we know, Hanawada said, nodding. Okay. And now you've made the pitch for proportional emigration, which is just as logical as allotting profits proportional to investment. But neither of these proposals is in your best interest. The emigration would be a drop in the bucket to you, but the money wouldn't. Meanwhile, the developed nations have a new population problem, so a chance at a larger share of emigration would be welcome. And they can spare the money, which would mostly go to transnationals anyway, and become free-floating capital outside any national control. So why shouldn't the developed nations give you more of it? It wouldn't really be coming out of their pocket anyway. Sung nodded quickly, looking solemn. Perhaps they had foreseen this response and made their proposal to stimulate it, and were waiting for him to play his part. But that just made it easier. Do you think your governments will agree to such a trade? Sung asked. Yes, Chalmers said. What is it but governments reasserting their power over the transnationals? Sharing the profits resembles in a way your old nationalization movements, only this time all countries would benefit. Internationalization, if you will. It will cut down on investments by the corporations, Hanawada noted. Which will please the Reds, Chalmers said. Please most of the Mars First group, in fact. And your government? Hanawada asked. I can guarantee it. Actually, the administration would be a problem. But Frank would deal with them when the time came. They were a bunch of Chamber of Commerce kids these days, arrogant but stupid. Tell them it was this or a third world Mars, a Chinese Mars, a Hindu Chinese Mars, with little brown people and cows unmolested in the walk tubes. They would come around. In fact, they would hide behind his knees yelling for protection. Grandpa Chalmers, please save me from the yellow horde. He watched the Indian and the Chinese look at each other in a completely scrutable consultation. Hell, he said. This is what you were hoping for, right? Perhaps we should work on some figures, Hanawada said. It took much of the next month to implement the compromise, as it entailed a whole set of corollary compromises to get all the voting delegations to accept it. Every nation's delegate had to get a cut to show the folks back home, and there was Washington to be convinced as well. In the end, Frank had to go over the heads of the kids right to the president, who was only a bit older than them, but could see a deal when it was poking him in the sternum. So Frank was busy, meetings nearly 16 hours a day in his old pattern, as familiar as the sunrise. In the end, mollifying transnat lobbyists like Andy Yans was the hardest part, essentially impossible, as the deal was being made at their expense, and they knew it. They put all the pressure they could on the northern governments and on their flags of convenience, and that was considerable, as evidenced by the president's scared irritability and the defection of Singapore and Sofia from the deal. But Frank convinced the president, even across all that space, even across the deep psychological barrier of the time lag, and he used the same arguments with every other northern government. If you give in to the transnationals, he would say, then they're the real government of the world. This is the chance to assert the interests of you and your population over those free-floating accumulations of capital which are very near to holding the ultimate power on Earth. You need to get them on the leash somehow. And it was the same at the UN for every official there. Who do you want to be the real world government, you or them? Still, it was a close thing. The pressures the transnats could bring to bear were awesome. It was impressive to watch. Subarashi and Armscor and Shalauko were each bigger than all but the 10 largest countries or commonwealths, and they really put out the funds. Money equals power. Power makes the law, and law makes government. So that the national governments, in trying to restrain the transnats, were like the Lilliputians trying to tie down Gulliver. They needed a great network of tiny lines, staked into place along every millimeter of the circumference. And as the giant heaved to free itself and start trampling about, they had to rush from side to side, throw new lines over the monster, hammer new little pin stakes into place. Rush around, making quarter-hour pinstake appointments for 16 hours a day. Mad Dutch boy juggling. Andy Jans, one of Frank's oldest corporate contacts, took him to dinner one night. Andy was angry with Chalmers, naturally, but tried to hide it, as the evening's business consisted of the offer of a bribe thinly disguised, accompanied by threats thinly veiled. Business as usual, in other words. He offered Chalmers a position as head of a foundation which was being set up by the Earth to Mars Transport Consortium. The old aerospace industries, with their old Pentagon stash still sloshing around in their pockets. This new foundation would assist the consortium to make policy and advise the UN on Mars-related matters. The position was to begin after his tenure as Secretary for Mars was over, to avoid any appearance of conflict of interest. "It sounds marvelous," Chalmers said. "I'm very interested indeed." And over the course of the dinner, he convinced Jans he was sincere, not only about taking the position in the Foundation, but in working for the consortium immediately. This was work indeed, but he was good at it. He could see the suspicion slowly leak out of Jans as the evening wore on. The weakness of businessmen was their belief that money was the point of the game. They worked 14-hour days in order to earn enough of it to buy cars with leather interiors. They thought it was a sensible recreation to play around with it in casinos. Idiots, in short. But useful idiots. "I'll do what I can," Chalmers promised energetically, and outlined some strategies he would start to pursue at once. Talk to the Chinese about their need for land. Get Congress back to the idea of a fair return on investments. Certainly. Make promises here, and some of the pressure would subside. Meanwhile, the work could go on. There was no pleasure like double-crossing a crook. So he went back to the conference table and carried on as before. The walk on the bridge, as it was now being called, others called it the Chalmers shift, had broken the impasse. February 6th, 2057 LS equals 144 M15, a red-letter date in the history of diplomacy. Now it was a matter of giving everyone else a piece and fixing the actual numbers. As this process ground along, Chalmers talked with all the first 100 observers there, reassuring them and checking their opinions. Sachs, it turned out, was upset with him because he thought that if the transnats ceased investment, his terraforming would have to slow considerably. He saw all the arriving business as heat, and yet Anne, too, was upset with him because a new treaty based on the shift would allow both emigration and investment, and she and the Reds had been hoping for a treaty that would give Mars a kind of world park status. That kind of disconnection from reality made him crazy. "I've just saved you 50 million Chinese immigrants," he yelled at her. "And you bitch at me because I haven't managed to send everyone back home. You bitch because I didn't work a miracle and turn this rock into a holy shrine right next door to a world that's beginning to look like Calcutta on a bad day. Anne, what would you have done? What would you have done except stalk around glaring at every single fucking thing people said and convincing everyone that you're from Mars? Jesus Christ. Go out and play with your rocks and leave the politics to people who can think." "Remember what thinking is, Frank," she said. Somehow he had made her smile for a second there in the middle of his tirade, but she laid the same old wild glare on him before she left. But Maya, now, Maya was pleased with him. He could feel her gaze on him when he talked in the public meetings. Millions of people watching, and he felt only that gaze. It made him angry. She was full of admiration for the bridge walk, and he told her only what she would be pleased to hear about the backstage compromises he was making in order to get it accepted. She began joining him every evening during the cocktail hour, approaching him when the first press of critics and supplicants had ebbed, standing by his side through the second and third waves, watching and easing things along with her laugh, and extricating him from time to time with reminders that they had to go out and eat. Then they would go out onto restaurant terraces under the stars and eat and then sip coffee, looking over the orange tiles and roof gardens under one of the big mesa-topping tents, feeling the evening breeze just as if they were out in the open. The Mars First crowd had committed themselves to his plan, so he had most of the locals and he had the home office, and those were the two most important single parties in the whole process, he judged, aside from the transnational leadership, which he could do little about. So it was only a matter of time before he would work the deal. As he would tell her sometimes late in the evenings when he had fallen a bit under her spell, been calmed by her. "Between us, we'll get it done," he would say as he looked up at the vivid stars in the sky, unable to meet her penetrating gaze. And one night she kept returning to his side during the cocktail gathering. With all the others, they watched the Terran news reports of the day's progress and saw again how oddly distorted and flattened they appeared, like tiny players in an incomprehensible soap opera. And then they left together and ate, and then went walking down the wide grassy boulevards, eventually coming to his room in the lower town. And she accompanied him inside, without exclamation or comment, in Maya's usual way. As if she always did this. It just happened, was happening. She was in his room, and then in his arms, hugging him. They lay on his bed, and she kissed him. The shock of it was such that Frank felt completely removed from his body. His flesh was like rubber. This was beginning to worry him when the sheer animal presence of her broke through the shock. Body spoke to body, and suddenly he could feel her again. Sensation flooded back into him, and he responded to it with animal intensity. It had been a long time. Afterward, she walked around with a white sheet draped over her like a cape, getting a glass of water. "I like the way you work those people," she said, her back to him. She drank from the glass, looked over her shoulder with her old affectionate grin, with that full and open gaze of hers, a gaze that seemed so insightful, like lased light shining right through him, that suddenly he felt not only naked, but exposed. He pulled the remaining sheet up over his hip, then felt that he had given himself away. Surely she would see the way the air turned to cold water in his lungs, the way his stomach knotted, the way his feet froze. He blinked, returned her smile. He knew it was a wan and crooked smile, but feeling his face like a stiff mask over his real flesh, he took comfort. No one could accurately read emotions from facial expressions. That was all a lie, a bogus relationship, as in palm reading or astrology, so he was safe. But after that night, she began spending a lot of time with him, both in public and private. She joined him at the receptions given every night by one or another of the national offices. She sat beside him at many of the group dinners. She sailed the hot sea of conversation with him afterward as they watched the bad news from Terra, or sat in the close knot of the first hundred. And she went with him to his room at night, or even more disturbing, took him to hers. And all without any sign of what she wanted from him. He could only conclude that she knew she didn't have to speak of it. That just being with him was enough, that he would know what she wanted and try his best to do it without her ever having to say a word. That she would get what she wanted. For of course it was impossible that she was doing it all without cause. That was the nature of power. When you had it, no one else was ever again simply a friend, simply a lover. Inevitably, they all wanted things you could give them. If nothing else, the prestige of friendship with the powerful. That was prestige that Maya didn't need, but she knew what she wanted. And wasn't he doing it, after all? Infuriating a large part of his power base to forge a treaty that would please no one but a handful of locals? Yes, she was getting what she wanted, and all without a word, or without a direct word, nothing but praise and affection. So that as he talked in the endless caucus conferences, carefully hammering out the wording of each clause of the new treaty, playing James Madison to this strange simulacrum of a constitutional convention, Spencer and Samantha and Maya would wander around helping him, and Maya would watch him with the most fractional smile, which revealed to him alone her approval, her pride in him. And then, energized by the day's work, he would roam the evening reception, and she would laugh at him and stand at his side and chatter with all the rest, a kind of consort. Hell, a consort! And at night shower him with kisses, until it was impossible to imagine that she did not like him. Which was intolerable. That it should be so easy to deceive even the people who knew you best, that she should be so stupid. It was shocking to realize these things more strongly than ever before. How hidden the true self is, he thought, under the phenomenological mask. In reality, they were all actors all the time, playing their video parts, and there was no chance of contact with the true selves inside others, not anymore. Over the long years, their parts had hardened into shells, and the selves inside had atrophied or wandered off and gotten lost. And now they were all hollow. Or perhaps it was just him. Because she seemed so real. Her laughter, her white hair, her passion, my God! Her sweaty skin and the ribs underneath it, ribs that slid back and forth under his fingers like the slats of a fence, ribs that clamped down on the paroxysms of orgasm. A true self. Didn't it have to be so? Didn't it? He could hardly believe otherwise. A true self. But sadly deceived. One morning he awoke from a dream of John. It was from their time together on the space station when they had been young, except in the dream they had been old, and John hadn't died, and yet he had. He spoke as a ghost, aware that he had died and that Frank had killed him, yet aware also of everything that had happened since and free of all anger or blame. It was just something that had happened. Like the time John had gotten the first landing assignment, or had taken Maya away on the Ares. A lot of things had happened between them one way or another, but they were still friends, still brothers. They could talk, they could understand each other. Feeling the horror of that, Frank had groaned through the dream and tried to fold in on himself, and awakened. It was hot. His skin was sweaty. Maya was sitting up, her hair wild, her breasts swinging loosely between her arms. "What's wrong?" she was saying. "What's wrong?" "Nothing," he cried, and got up and padded to the bathroom. But she came after him, put her hands on him. "Frank, what is it?" "Nothing," he shouted, involuntarily jerking out of her grip. "Can't you leave me alone?" "Of course," she said, hurt, a flush of anger. "Of course I can." And she walked out of the bathroom. "Of course you can," he shouted after her, suddenly furious at her stupidity, to be so ignorant of him, so vulnerable to him when it was all an act anyway. "Now that you've got what you want from me." "What does that mean?" she said, reappearing instantly in the bathroom doorway, a sheet around her. "You know what I mean," he said bitterly. "You've got what you wanted from the treaty, haven't you? And you never would have without me." She stood there, hands on her hips, watching him. The sheet was loose around her hips, and she looked like the French figure of liberty, very beautiful and very dangerous, her mouth a tight line. She shook her head in disgust and walked away. "You don't have the faintest idea, do you?" she said. He followed her. "What do you mean?" She threw the sheet away and stepped violently into her underwear, yanked it up over her bottom. As she dressed, she hurled short sentences at him. "You don't know anything about what other people think. You don't even know what you think. What do you want out of the treaty? You, Frank Chalmers. You don't know. It's only what I want, what Sachs wants, what Helmuth wants, what any of them want. You yourself have no opinion. Whatever is easiest to manage, whatever leaves you in control at the end. And as for feelings..." She was dressed, standing at the door. She stopped to glare at him, a look like a lightning strike. He had been standing there too stunned to move, and so now he stood there naked before her, exposed to the full blast of her scorn. "You don't have any feelings, do you? I've tried, believe me, but you just..." She shuddered, apparently unable to think of words vile enough to describe him. Hollow, he wanted to say. Empty. An act. And yet... She walked out.